today. Accusations of racism inside the Windrush compensation scheme, made by the woman who was its most senior black member of staff. It's almost hard to believe this. But the scheme that was set up to deal with perhaps the biggest injustice involving race in recent British history, the Windrush compensation scheme, is itself now facing complaints of racism and discrimination.
It was a culture that was toxic. It was a culture that refused to acknowledge its own racism.
Alexandra Ankara was the most senior black member of staff inside the Home Office's compensation scheme.
It was a culture that did things for show. It was a culture that was never going to serve the needs of those people who had been hurt and harmed. And I didn't want to be part of that.
Now Alexandra has spoken out for the first time. One of the people who has been hurt by the problems with the compensation scheme is Samantha, whose partner Eddie passed away before he could get any financial help.
It feels like the system is exactly what Eddie was up against in the first place. It doesn't feel like there's anybody human at the other end.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, racism within the Windrush compensation scheme. On November the 28th, 2017, The Guardian's Amelia Gentleman wrote the first story in a series that would reveal what has now become known as the Windrush scandal. Almost exactly 3 years have passed, and yet she is still hearing from people facing injustice. Some of the most worrying stories are about the problems victims are having with the very scheme that was set up to compensate them.
Some people are concerned about the really long delays between applying and being awarded compensation. Others told me that they're very unhappy about the very low offers that they've been given. And many, many more have simply had real difficulties in filling in the form. It's a difficult form to fill in, and there isn't any money for legal advice to help people. One of the cases I think that I've been most disturbed by is Samantha Cooper, who's the widow of a man called Eddie Lindsay. I've been in touch with Samantha on and off now for a couple of years, and her experiences with trying to get compensation are really, really troubling.
Samantha, your late partner Eddie came to Britain from Jamaica in 1960 when he was a child, and he never left. This was his home. You had two daughters together. And then in 2012, he got wrapped up in the Windrush scandal, although who knew what it was then. He was working for Tesco's at the time. Tell me what happened.
Everything was just ticking along as normal. And then he just came home saying, I've got to apply for a British passport to prove I have the right to work in the UK. He wasn't really too bothered about it at the time. He was just thinking it was ludicrous. And I said, OK, we'll apply for a British passport. And we did. And he got refused. The passport application came back with the onus was on him to prove his identity and right to stay in the UK.
How stressful was that for you?
Extremely, extremely stressful, because in the end, he lost his job.
And that was because he didn't have the paperwork?
Yeah.
Things became even more stressful when Samantha fell ill and lost her job as a healthcare worker, meaning they had gone from having two incomes to none. And then Eddie was diagnosed with cancer.
He went through all the chemo and really bravely as well. He never complained once. And I know, you know, you hear stories of people being brave and not complaining, but Eddie honestly never complained once. Like I said, he underwent all the chemo and then had a scan at the end of May, and they said the cancer had doubled in size in the pancreas and spread to the liver, and there was nothing more they could do for him. And he would have 12 to 18 months, and he only saw 5.
Before he died, there was one thing Eddie was determined to do: marry his partner of 25 years.
He said that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to get married. So family members organised a service up at his family church in Forest Gate. The vicar had performed a marriage ceremony. We were married in the eyes of God.
But sadly, not in the eyes of Britain's legal system, because the government was refusing to give Eddie the paperwork he needed.
How did you feel when you started seeing stories about the Windrush generation?
Furious, absolutely furious I was. After Ed died, I had trouble sleeping. So I'd watch Sky News on repeat, really. I'd just have Sky News on. And I couldn't believe my ears when it broke. I was so furious that I think I sent out emails to everybody that I could find, David Lammy and all sorts of different people. I think The Guardian was one of them, actually.
Did you send an email to Amelia?
Yeah, I think I did. I didn't know at the time. I just fired off all these emails that I could see that it was, you know, I just emailed everybody I could think of saying this was my situation. This was Eddie. What they were describing was Eddie's situation.
Tell me about that anger you were feeling.
I thought we was on our own with it. I didn't realise it was a massive issue, a massive problem that, you know, thousands of people were going through. And I was shocked.
Samantha thought they were the only people having these types of problems. Looking back, what would it have meant for your life if this had never happened, if the government had not targeted the Windrush generation, including Eddie?
If Ed had been able to prove his identity in 2012, we would have been able to marry. Means I wouldn't have been insignificant when he died. Literally the day he died, I called, I think it was the Department of Work and Pensions or Tax Credits, and they said, well, you're single. I said, no, I'm widowed. I said, no, you're single.
Last year, the government recognised its mistake, recognised how wrong it had been to treat people like Eddie and Samantha and thousands of others in that way, and it set up a compensation scheme expected to pay out between £90 and £250 million. But when she tried to make a claim, Samantha found herself facing the same problems once again.
I applied for compensation as soon as the compensation scheme was released. And it turns out I really, really needed a marriage certificate.
And so Samantha's claim was rejected, and she was told that either her daughters would have to apply or she could try again as a close family member rather than as a spouse.
I get they have to be really stringent with their system and, you know, they have to be really careful that compensation only goes to people that deserve it. But when you've got all that evidence in front of you and the only thing is stopping you is because you can't find a marriage certificate, I'm saying, look, I've got the video. I've got the photographs. I've sent photographs in with the original application.
But you couldn't get married because of the system, because of the system they're setting up to compensate. That's the only reason.
And that's why I will not go away. I will not leave it lie, because in my eyes, the government prevented the marriage and I'm entitled. That's why I will not tell my children, well, you've got to go and claim on dad's behalf. They're grieving the loss of their father. They don't want to do that. And I want them to continue living their lives and not looking backwards and look forwards.
What would the compensation mean for you?
It would mean security. It would mean I could clear outstanding debt and breathe. It would mean I could tell my daughters that it's okay, you know, you've got the security that dad meant for you to have.
Since Amelia highlighted Samantha's story in The Guardian, she has been contacted by a caseworker to reassure her that they are processing her claim. Amelia, Samantha's story is heartbreaking and incredibly frustrating, but I know she's not the only one. What are the other problems victims have come up against with this scheme?
I think the other real difficulty is that the scheme requires people to give a lot of documentary evidence proving the exact nature of the difficulties that they experienced and proving that they experienced trauma as a result of it all. But actually, that's really, really hard to do. A lot of people didn't go to the doctor to say that they were feeling traumatized by the experience because they tend to be of a generation who are very stoical.
What does the Home Office say about these problems and delays?
what they do say is they are trying to get this right, that they understand that there may be delays in some cases because it's simply the process of making sure that the payments are correct.
These are complicated cases. And in fact, last week, Mr. Deputy Speaker, when I was here at the House answering oral questions and this issue came up, I put the offer to many honourable members on the opposite benches to even come into the Home Office and to spend some time with our casework team to understand the complexities of the various cases.
And I think, you know, to a certain extent, there is some truth in that. I think the problem is that there hasn't been a real sense of urgency about this. And what I'm really upset by is coming across more and more people who have applied for compensation, but who've died before receiving it. And that figure is about 9 people now who've died before receiving compensation.
It was when Hubert Howard died, waiting for compensation a year ago, that Amelia last came to us to raise her frustrations with the Windrush process. When she realised that the problems had still not stopped, she decided she needed to know more about what was going on inside the Home Office's compensation scheme. And it was then that she was given the name of its most senior Black member of staff, who she discovered had quit earlier this year, because of the culture she had witnessed in the Home Office.
So I'm Alexandra Ankra, and I used to work with the Windrush Compensation Scheme.
Before joining the Home Office, Alexandra had been a barrister and then worked in another part of the civil service where she described feeling isolated because of the lack of diversity at a senior level. She knew people who had come to Britain as part of the Windrush generation through her community and church, and as a result, she began hearing about the troubles they were having as early as 2015, long before this became a controversy in the media. And what did you think when you first started hearing those stories and first started reading about it?
I was, I suppose, like most people, incredulous, couldn't quite understand why things were not being resolved, and was lending support as best I could.
And did you talk about it at work?
Well, certainly didn't talk about it at work because, as I mentioned, I was certainly isolated. So I was sort of on my own, as I mentioned, because of the particularly low level of Black representation.
Amelia, Alexandra's own personal experience meant she had a sense of what was starting to happen in these communities, but didn't feel able to raise it at work. She wanted to find a way to help, so she applied to work on the compensation scheme itself inside the Home Office and was shocked to find that even there, she was the only senior Black member of staff. But the lack of diversity wasn't the only thing that began to worry her, was it?
Well, she was really concerned that there were a lot of people involved in the compensation scheme who had come over from immigration enforcement roles, or who in some cases continue to have immigration enforcement roles as part of their wider job description. And I think that that's the issue that she found really, really difficult. The very people who were meant to be being empathetic to those affected were also responsible for implementing some of the policies that had caused all of the problems in the first place.
Does it also inevitably mean that if the hostile environment was run by these individuals, then that culture is completely embedded in the way they work, so they inevitably would have brought that culture with them?
Well, I think that's what's so interesting in talking to Alexandra is the picture that she paints of, you know, some of the attitudes of the people that she's working with who are robust in the way that they're dealing with people who've had very, very traumatic experiences. And I'm sure, you know, that there are a number of really, really good people working in the compensation scheme. I'm sure that there is, for a lot of senior staff, a desire to get this right and to be fair. And I really want to stress that I think it's important that people who are in the process of applying don't get disheartened and do persist in applying because the scheme is set up to help them. I just think it was really sobering to hear Alexandra describe how elements of that team echo the problematic attitudes within the Home Office that helped to cause the problem in the first place.
My peer colleagues working in policy roles were white, and mainly their careers had been in the Home Office. They hadn't worked outside of the Home Office, and in a number of cases, their careers had begun as presenting officers, representing the Home Office in cases of appeal, for example.
She told me that she had been dismayed because some of her colleagues appeared to be quite grudging about the payments they were making. One person told her people should be happy with whatever they get. And she noted that there was sometimes a lack of sympathy towards people who died without making a will.
My colleague turned to me in a meeting, one of our lawyers, and said, "Too bad, they should have made a will." So in that moment, I immediately asked everyone around the table, and there would have been about six people, "Which of you has got a will?" None of them had a will. So the expectation that we were prepared to allow people to be put through hurdles on the basis that for some reason it was their fault, they didn't have a will, I felt sick and sickened. And I said I felt sick and sickened by that.
You know, why would you make a will if you have been made destitute as a result of losing your job, as a result of a Home Office mistake? So she was troubled by this very hardline attitude expressed by colleagues over and over again.
You could see huge problems in the way the scheme was being operated. If we just think about the wider culture in the department, did it feel like racism?
It didn't feel like racism. It was racism. It was racism because if we look at the definition of, well, maybe I shouldn't say if we look at the definition of institutional racism, but if we look at things like the McPherson report and we look at ostriches that bury their head in the sand, there was a lot of burying heads in sand. And I think when you have a philosophy that underpins a scheme that is talking about colourblindness, then you have problems. One of my bosses said to me that my problem was that I looked at these policy issues on Windrush through the prism of race. Now, I'm a black woman, and so of course I look at life as a black woman whose lived experience is as a black woman. And that's what I told this boss. So the boss then said to me, "Yes, I can see that it's a challenge because you identify as black." I don't identify as black. I am black. That's one of the most sophisticated ways anyone's ever told me I had a chip on my shoulder.
The Home Office has said that it rejects any suggestion that the Windrush compensation scheme is discriminatory or that it does not support victims. It was designed, they say, with victims' interests at heart and to cover every conceivable circumstance in which a person may have found themselves. They say the scheme is more inclusive and open than any other compensation scheme in the UK. How do you respond to that?
I think the response is easy. An open and accessible scheme would be delivering today and tomorrow. An open and accessible scheme would be ensuring that the people who have been hurt and harmed had an apology. And it would most of all be putting those very people at the centre of everything that scheme was intended and is intended to do. So I think we only need to listen to the survivors to hear their story, to recognise that there's something very badly wrong. And if the Home Office wants to rebut the statements of people who have suffered, people who are continuing to suffer, if it just wants to set out some glib press lines, then actually I think the case is really demonstrated that it's not listening to the very people who it needs to listen to.
Overall, Amelia, What Alexandra was talking about was a systemic issue within the Home Office. And she was in no doubt about what was driving it. She called it racism. What did you think when she first said that to you?
I think what Alexandra says echoes what has been said again and again by people who've been affected by this scandal. There is a sense that the Home Office has got it wrong on race and is continuing to do so.
How many people have actually received compensation from the scheme? And do we know how much they're getting?
By the end of October, the compensation scheme had been running for 18 months and only £1.6 million had been paid out to 196 people. And that's very low if you think that the Home Office was expecting around 15,000 people to apply.
Coming up, will this force the Home Office to reform? Amelia, the stories we've just heard are really shocking, both from a victim of this scandal, Samantha, and someone who worked within the department that is meant to be sorting it out. Alexandra quit in April, not long after the government published its Lessons Learned review into the Windrush scandal, and I know it highlighted problems in the Home Office. What exactly did it find?
The report was written by Wendy Williams, who is a semi-independent figure within the Home Office. Wendy Williams didn't go as far as saying that the Home Office was institutionally racist, but many of her findings are very critical of the Home Office on the issue of race.
I've made the point that the Windrush scandal was both foreseeable and avoidable.
Wendy Williams found that warnings were repeatedly ignored, and she said it came about in part because of officials' poor understanding of Britain's colonial history.
I guess Alexandra's story tells us that that culture carried on even when they were trying to tackle the Windrush scandal. And she specifically talked about the lack of diversity within the senior team, which I know the report highlighted. Earlier, we talked about the fact that Alexandra was also aware of Windrush problems, but had no way of raising them. Did other officials know about this as well?
It's highlighted that there was such a dysfunctionality within the Home Office that junior staff members felt unable to flag their concerns to senior members of staff because they didn't feel that they would be listened to. So I think it's absolutely the case that Home Office employees were beginning to be aware all over the country that things weren't going right and that there was this kind of looming problem.
What did Wendy Williams actually recommend?
She came up with 30 detailed proposals for how the Home Office should improve itself to make sure that such a thing could never be allowed to happen again. She requested that the Home Office launch a review into the hostile environment policies that were responsible for all of this. She said that the entire culture of the Home Office needs to be reformed. And she also recommended this training for all Home Office staff in terms of their attitudes towards history and empire.
It's absolutely important for the department to learn the lessons of Windrush. I set out what needs to happen in order for that to occur. And everyone is watching, everyone is waiting, and everyone is looking to the Home Office, that's both ministers and officials, to lead that charge.
And how did Priti Patel, who was Home Secretary by then, respond?
We've had now apologies from three consecutive Home Secretaries, and Priti Patel responded to the review when it was published in March by apologising again to those affected.
I am truly sorry for the actions that spanned decades, and I'm sorry that people's trust has been betrayed.
Then in the summer, just after Windrush Day in June, she announced that she would be adopting all 30 of those recommendations.
We are determined to get this right. We owe it to the Windrush generation and, of course, their descendants.
And at the end of September, she published a really detailed 50-page improvement plan for the Home Office. And so on the one hand, I think people affected can feel that they've really been listened to. On the other hand, I think there is some apology fatigue amongst those affected, because now it's been 2.5 years of the government promising things, apologising, saying that they're going to put things right in the future, but not that many of those promises have yet materialised in a really concrete form.
In fact, if anything, aren't the suggestions that have been coming out of the Home Office since then doubling down on the idea of creating a hostile environment? There have been reports about a wave machine in the Channel to push back dinghies being considered, and even talk of processing asylum seekers on an island thousands of miles away.
I mean, some of those reports are likely not to be, won't ever come to be the case, but there is something very politically interesting about the Home Office's need to do this peculiar doublespeak. So on the one hand, say we're going to become compassionate and fair.
Have no doubt, where we find problems, I will seek to fix them.
And yet, on the other hand, think it's important to continue saying to the Conservative political base, presumably, that the Home Office is going to be very, very robust and tough on immigration.
But equally, be under no illusion, if people are here wrongly or illegally, then naturally we will act.
What are you left feeling after unearthing yet another scandal involving the Windrush generation?
Discouraged, I suppose. It's almost exactly 3 years since I met Paulette Wilson, who was the first person that The Guardian focused on when we began to highlight this issue.
37 years of paying taxes and I got a letter saying that I was a legal immigrant.
Paulette Wilson, if you remember, was somebody who'd been here for 50 years, who'd arrived from Jamaica at the age of 10 in the late 1960s.
I knew I was sent for a better life.
Who was twice arrested by the Home Office and sent to Yarlswood Detention Centre and was on the point of being deported back to Jamaica, a country she hadn't lived in for 50 years. Unfortunately, Paulette died prematurely in the summer. She was campaigning for justice right up until her death, and she hadn't really received it. She'd had some compensation, but not the full amount that she deserved. And I just think it's really, really disappointing.
Amelia, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Amelia Gentleman, Alexandra Ankara, and Samantha Cooper. My thanks to them. You can read Amelia's reporting on this at theguardian.com. There are a number of other issues facing the Home Office right now, including the bullying claim surrounding Priti Patel, the Home Secretary. Do follow our Westminster team to find out more on that story. We also mentioned the suggestion that the Home Office had been interested in an Australian scheme to process asylum seekers offshore. Rachel Humphreys hosted a brilliant Today in Focus episode on this recently, interviewing journalist Ben Doherty. I do recommend it. That is it for today. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore. Sound design was by Nicholas Cox. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.